Welcome back to The Takeaway. I'm Arun Venugopal. On December 1st, 1955, Rosa Parks refused to give up her seat on a Montgomery, Alabama bus, setting off the Montgomery bus boycott and eventually leading to the desegregation of Alabama's buses. But the history of Black Americans protesting discrimination on public transit has roots that stretch back a lot further. And one piece of that history came 100 years before Rosa Parks on the streets of New York City.
So Elizabeth Jennings Graham is probably one of the most influential New Yorkers and by extension Americans that people have never heard of.
That's Concetta Ann Bensavenga. She's the director of the New York Transit Museum. The woman she's talking about, Elizabeth Jennings Graham, was a 27-year-old African-American woman, a teacher, an organist at her church, and born and raised in New York City. Mass transit in the city at the time meant just two things.
There are streetcars, which are railroads. Literally, the rails are in the road and pulled by horses. And then there are omnibuses. And those are kind of like covered wagons, also pulled by horses. So those are your mass transit options.
And both subjected Black New Yorkers to discrimination.
Now, there were no laws that precluded African Americans from taking any car that they wanted to. But there were rules that were sort of quasi-enforced in these privately held corporations that were pretty onerous. And the rule was sort of like, well, you can try and get on, but if anyone objects, you have to get off.
And so on a muggy July day in 1854, Elizabeth Jennings Graham would experience that racism firsthand when she went to get on a streetcar, part of the Third Avenue Railroad. She was trying to get to church to play the organ for mass. She flags down the first streetcar that comes along, a streetcar meant for white passengers only, and she boards the car with her friend, Sarah.
The conductor comes up to them and says, no, no, you can't get on this car. You'll have to wait for one that's for your kind. She takes great exception to this, but she cedes the point and says, fine, we'll wait for the next carriage, which would have been appropriate for African Americans to get on.
But the next streetcar that approaches is too full. It won't take her or her friend.
So then she says, great, I'm not leaving. Then a scuffle ensues. She is basically bodily thrown off of the streetcar.
The next Sunday, Elizabeth brings a statement about the incident with her to read aloud at church. In it, she says,
I told him I was a respectable person, born and raised in New York, did not know where he was born, that I had never been insulted before while going to church, and that he was a good-for-nothing, impudent fellow for insulting decent persons while on their way to church. And really, a movement is born. And they decide that that's it. They're going to sue the Third Avenue Railroad Corporation.
With the help of her well-connected father, she looks for a lawyer to take the case and finds an attorney just starting out in his mid-20s, Chester Arthur, who would, of course, later go on to be president of the United States.
He's a very young attorney, and this is sort of his out-of-the-box, one of his first trials that he's ever tried. And so they have to go to court, and they have to present this information in front of a jury that's comprised of 12 Caucasian men. And Elizabeth Jennings is suing for $500 in damages.
So the judge told the jury,
the Third Avenue Railroad was indeed liable for the actions of their agents, and that colored persons had the same rights as others, could neither be excluded by any rules of the company, nor by force or violence. So the jury comes back and finds in favor of Elizabeth Jennings for $225, which was an incredible amount of money. But also the precedent is now set, and they've won, and they've called this a wonderful righteous victory, is how it's described in the press.
The victory was covered by the local media, but also reverberated beyond the limits of the city.
It was also carried in some of the abolitionist newspapers. We know that there's an article that was as far away as Wisconsin, and they were calling it a wholesome verdict. That's Frederick Douglass called it a wholesome verdict.
But that wholesome verdict didn't mean immediate change.
That was a court victory, but it wasn't the law. The civil rights law of New York City doesn't go into effect till 1873.
And Elizabeth didn't stay a visible part of the ongoing struggle for civil rights in her city.
She remains an educator for her entire life and ends up starting a kindergarten and moves to Jersey and then moves back to the city. But she kind of removes herself from public life. She's made her statement. She won her case. She set a precedent. But she did not really kind of take up the mantle. She receded from public life. And as an unintended consequence, I think her story receded from public life as well.
But it looks like that might be changing. Last year, it was announced that there will soon be a statue erected in honor of Elizabeth Jennings Graham at Grand Central Terminal right here in New York City.
She set the wheels in motion to change mass transit history in New York and then collectively our history for forever and for better.
Concetta Ann Bensivenga is the director of the New York Transit Museum. We just heard the story of Elizabeth Jennings Graham, who stood up against segregated transportation in New York in the 1850s. Well, public transportation has continued to be the site of battles over segregation and discrimination in the U.S. throughout history, even to this day. What makes mass transit such a critical site of social change, especially when it comes to racial equity? I have two historians with me to help answer that question. Elizabeth Storter Pryor is a history professor at Smith College. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi there.
And Blair L.M. Kelly is associate professor of history at North Carolina State University. Blair, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Blair, let's start with Elizabeth Jennings, who we heard about a few minutes ago. She was one of so many who resisted in this way. Can you tell us about the movement that followed in response to her story?
Well, after her basic sit-in and her ejection from what was deemed de facto the all-white car, she won that case, as you all mentioned. But the laws did not change for the majority of riders. The majority of riders could be ejected summarily based on the whims of the conductors. And so the Reverend Pennington, a former slave who was self-educated, becomes the voice of this movement in the 1850s in New York City. And hundreds of people are protesting on the cars in much the same way that they were 100 years later.
Elizabeth, when you look back on the history of transit-related discrimination, where do you think the story really begins?
I mean, it begins as soon as free people start, you know, trying to travel and have the financial ability. Free people of color have the financial ability to travel. They start talking about it. The earliest case that I've come across is Paul Cuffee. In like 1814 or so, he was a black sea captain who traveled from Boston down to D.C. and on his way down, you know, ran into problems on a stagecoach where a white male passenger was insisting that he was making it impossible for women, white women, to ride in the stagecoach with him. And he stood up for himself. But he was accustomed to that kind of behavior. And, you know, through the stagecoach history, steamship history, and into the railroads and the streetcars, this behavior falls. And in fact, the idea of the Jim Crow segregation, the Jim Crow car, starts in the 1830s in the Massachusetts railroads.
And you had civil rights icons like Frederick Douglass, Ida B. Wells, a lot of them. They stood up against segregation on transit, didn't they?
Right. Well, I mean, certainly Ida B. Wells does so much later. But in the early years, Frederick Douglass, David Ruggles, William Wells Brown, Harriet Jacobs, all of these activists preceded Elizabeth Jennings and were recognized that access to public transportation was paramount to their citizenship rights. They understood.
Elizabeth, the North has historically been painted as a more progressive region in terms of segregation after the Civil War, but how do you see its role in the history of transit segregation?
Well, you know, it's when black people start becoming free in the North in numbers that these battles really start to begin. And the battles begin because black people with the financial ability and the wherewithal demand the right to ride. Now, I think it's important to note that segregation didn't just mean sitting at the back of the bus or even waiting for the black car to come along. It was a totally different quality of, you know, you'd be riding with coal and animals and alcoholics and smoke and dirt and on the outside and ruin your clothes. It was a big deal.
Blair, what is it about transit in particular that's made it such a major site of protest and change?
Well, transit's something that people can't avoid. They can't just choose not to travel to work or to church or school. They have to get around these urban spaces that are increasingly growing throughout the time period we've been discussing. And we know that physical mobility is linked to social mobility. People's ability to find new jobs, new housing, new opportunities is linked to being able to get on transportation freely. And so you can imagine what it's like to live a life where you're constantly insulted when you enter on these conveyances, and you're subject to the possibility of physical violence. We have to remember that Elizabeth Jennings herself was grabbed by the feet and dragged across the floor of the streetcar when she was ejected. A tremendous embarrassment, a tremendous physical harm to someone who was just 25 years old, educated, on her way to church. So you didn't know what was going to happen to you. So it was such an important thing to have an everyday civil right respected. And people of all classes fought immediately for that dignity, for their right to ride.
And that, I guess, if you flash forward more than 100 years later, you had the Freedom Riders in 1961 doing the same thing to desegregate transit and public spaces, correct?
Absolutely. It reminds us that it's an ongoing struggle. There's a struggle in the North in the 1850s that's very collective in New York City and in Philadelphia. There's a struggle at the turn of the century on the streetcars of the American South in 25 different southern cities. There are boycotts and protests. And then all the way to the Civil Rights Movement, where transportation again becomes a locus for the Montgomery bus boycott movement all the way through the Freedom Riders.
What do you think is the most significant, I guess, outcome from all of these protests?
I think, I don't know that we really understand the importance of it. I think the ways in which we're seeing challenges to people's affordability as cities gentrify and grow and people are more dependent on public transportation, we haven't seen a real understanding of the importance of a need for equal access, affordable access, dignity in those spaces. And so I don't know that we've learned the lesson. I think it's one that we have to keep going over and over.
Elizabeth, this language, or rather this issue, plays out not just in terms of legal rights, but also the language about transportation, right? You have phrases like the wrong side of the tracks. It kind of permeates our culture in terms of how we talk and think about segregation and class and divides in general.
I mean, certainly. And I just want to reiterate, again, the idea of this Jim Crow car, right? The idea that the term that we think of associated most with segregation is something that comes out of a site of transportation is significant, because this is really the front line for Black activists and Black radicals becomes getting into these spaces. It's so much, as Blair said, a part of dignity and citizenship and safety. You know, people were in danger. Women were dying on steamships, Black women, when they were not allowed inside of the cabin. And
And Elizabeth, I mean, are you watching closely what's happening, say, here in New York City? You have people protesting subway fare hikes, the increase of police presence. Do you see this as a continuation of that longer history or a distinct issue?
Well, no, I think the need for safe, affordable transportation has a long trajectory. And those demands are, I think they're being made in New York now in this way, and they've been made ever since people could travel. They wanted the same, you know, the same respect that they could afford, and people want that now.
Blair, what do you make of the fact that, at least in New York, you see the government adding more police officers at a time where it's not especially dangerous, statistically speaking, to travel, and yet enforcement is becoming yet again a big priority there?
It's an awful echo of this earlier time period. In many of the streetcar boycotts that I study, part of the laws that were passed in southern cities automatically made conductors policemen in order to enforce segregation in those spaces. And so it's a bad echo with a history that we don't want to repeat. And so I'd caution us to think more progressively about what is possible on transportation, about how we can increase access for people, how we can make things more affordable so that people who live in gentrifying cities where they're pushed to the margins can afford to get around. They need that access more than ever, and we are making it harder and harder.
Do you see, I guess, limitations on movement as being something that's just sort of like a byproduct, or rather a conscious attempt to, even in this day and age, to limit the movement of, as you say, of people of color and the likes?
I think it's just thoughtlessness. I think it's a failure to know our history. I think it's a failure to think from the perspective of others. I think it's a failure to imagine yourself as someone else and in someone else's shoes.
And Elizabeth, what work are you seeing that's happening in response to that reality right now?
Well, you know, all I want to say is that, you know, I agree with this idea of the deputization, that part of segregation is being left out, but the policing is very much a part of that story too. And I think we can't forget that the policing isn't a response, but it's at the center of what segregation is all about.
Elizabeth Storter Pryor is a history professor at Smith College, and Blair L.M. Kelly is an associate professor of history at North Carolina State University. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for having me.